Amen. Good morning, family. Before we turn our attention to Ecclesiastes chapter 8, I want you to think with me for a moment about the life of Joseph. Joseph is truly one of the most remarkable stories, his story, one of the most remarkable stories in all of Scripture. Joseph was, of course, hated by his brothers, perhaps for good reason. He was betrayed by them, thrown into a pit. Most of them wanted to kill him, and then one of the brothers decided to convince the others to sell him into slavery instead. He was sold into slavery, ended up in Egypt, and ended up in the house of a man named Potiphar, a very important man in Egypt. And he seemed to be doing well for a while until he was falsely accused by Potiphar's wife, thrown into prison and left there to rot. And despite all of these challenges, despite all of the suffering that Joseph endured, he did not crumble. He was faithful amidst evil authorities. He was faithful despite deep injustices. How is it that this man, Joseph, a sinner like us, was able to be so faithful? I think the answer is that Joseph had the gift of wisdom. Joseph was a wise man. In fact, eventually, after Joseph interpreted Pharaoh's dreams to him, the king of Egypt said in the book of Genesis, he said this to Joseph, he said, "There is none so discerning and wise as you are." Wisdom really can help us in the middle of trials. Wisdom can allow us to do well, even to thrive in the middle of suffering. And yet, wisdom will not shield you from suffering entirely. Certainly didn't for Joseph. He was lied about, sold to his enemies for a few pieces of silver, falsely accused, arrested, and mistreated. The story of Joseph screams a powerful truth. Wisdom helps us respond rightly to unjust authority, but it cannot fix everything. That's the big idea we're also going to see in our text in Ecclesiastes chapter 8 this morning. Wisdom helps us respond rightly to unjust authority, but it cannot fix everything. And before we begin studying Ecclesiastes 8, I just want to tell you a little bit about how difficult it was for me to prepare this sermon. Now, I work pretty far ahead, so I've been studying Ecclesiastes for months and months and months. And by that time, typically, on Monday, which is the day that I write sermons, typically if I have a really, really good study day, I can get 75 to 90% of the sermon written on Monday. Which means then Tuesday through the rest of the week, I can do all the other things that you pay me to do. Which is a little bit more than just writing sermons. It's visiting people and counseling and meetings and all the other things that I'm involved in. Typically, if it's the sermon's done on Monday, the rest of the week goes great. Well, Monday came and went, and the sermon wasn't written. In fact, I didn't even have an outline. I couldn't even figure out what to make of Ecclesiastes chapter 8. So I studied Monday night, and it didn't help. Tuesday, I studied some more. It didn't help. Tuesday night, I studied some more. It didn't help. Not until Wednesday morning. You have to know a little bit about me. My anxiety level is rising incredibly. And so the closer it gets to Sunday, I know the sermon's not done. I need to figure this out. I don't even know how to make sense of this passage. Until Wednesday morning as I was studying, I realized something about Ecclesiastes chapter 8 that I had missed before. Ecclesiastes chapter 8 features a Hebrew poetic device called an inclusio. Now, you don't need to take a quiz on that. You don't need to remember that. But if it helps you, an inclusio is it's a poetic feature. It's regularly seen in the Old Testament where there's like a topic that's bookended. So the phrase or a theme is repeated at the beginning and then at the end of a passage. Well, there's an inclusio in Ecclesiastes chapter 8, and it's all about wisdom. Well, let me show you. Look at verse 1 of Ecclesiastes chapter 8. Who is like the wise? And who knows the interpretation of a thing? Now you notice right away the author, the preacher, is talking to us about wisdom. So we get a clue. This chapter is going to be about wisdom. But why don't you notice also this rhetorical question that the preacher's asking. Who is like the wise? Often when the preacher asks these rhetorical questions, the answer is nobody, right? But here, I think that we would understand there are wise people. Joseph being one, Solomon being one. He's not saying there is no one wise, but wisdom is very rare. If you keep reading in verse 1, you'll notice a benefit of wisdom. A man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the hardness of his face is changed. I think sometimes we're tempted to think that a wise person is very serious looking. You know, kind of has a perpetual scowl on their face. If they look very serious and kind of a little bit grumpy, they're probably very wise. But the preacher says, probably not. Wisdom actually gives you a smile. Wisdom lightens the face. Wisdom allows the hardness of your face to be changed. It could be that person that looks incredibly wise is just incredibly grumpy. And it could be that person that's got that maybe naive-looking smile on their face all the time is a lot wiser than you think. Well, that's the beginning part of wisdom here. Now go to the end of Ecclesiastes chapter 8, where wisdom is once again repeated. Look at verses 16 and 17. When I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done on earth, how neither day nor night do one's eyes see sleep, then I saw all the work of God, that man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. However much man may toil in seeking, he will not find it out. Even though a wise man claims to know, he cannot find it out. At the end of the chapter, the preacher is again talking about wisdom, but here his emphasis is a little bit different. In verse 1, he's mentioning the way that wisdom can transform us, but in the final verses, he's saying, even if you're incredibly wise, you're not going to figure it all out. No matter how wise you are, no matter how much wisdom you have, it will not fix everything. It will not answer all of your questions. It will not solve all of your problems, which is why our big idea, we say that wisdom helps, but it can't fix everything. Now, the middle part of our big idea comes by looking at verses 2 to 15. And in verses 2 to 15, we see a whole lot of information about evil and unjust kings and injustices, which is why we said that wisdom helps us respond rightly to unjust authority. So from verses 2 to 15 this morning, from the remainder of the verses in our text, I want to show you, with God's help, six principles for responding rightly, for responding wisely to unjust authority. Now, before we dive in, most of you, you're never going to suffer the way that Joseph did. Most of us will never face injustices the way that the people of Israel did when they were enslaved by Pharaoh in Egypt. Most of us will never face these kind of traumatic sufferings that many saints before us have faced. And yet, we all feel the weight of life in a broken world. All of you do. Every single one of you has experienced, to some degree, the pain and the frustration of disappointing leaders, of evil authorities, of something wrong that's allowed to thrive. Well, it seems like your world continues to suffer. How do we navigate those situations? We all need wisdom, which means we need Ecclesiastes chapter 8. And consider with me principle number 1, how to respond rightly to unjust authority. Remember that God establishes authority. If you want to have wisdom in an unjust world with wicked rulers, you need to remember that God is the one that installs them. Look at verse 2. I say, keep the king's command because of God's oath to him. It begins with a command to us. You need to obey the king. You need to submit to authority. And he gives us a reason, because of God's oath to him. And that's a little bit of a confusing phrase. Could be that the preacher is talking about the promises that God made to King David, that there would always be someone on the throne. Or it could be, as a footnote in the ESV suggests, the language could read, because of your oath to God. In other words, if you are a follower of the true God, Christian say, if you're a follower of Jesus, you have a responsibility to submit to your authority because you submit to God. Because God is the one that installs your authority. You won't find this any clearer than in the book of Daniel chapter 2, where Daniel tells us this: blessed be the name of God forever and ever. To whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. Here's the bottom line. Because God is the one that establishes our authority, we must submit to them. Do not submit to your authority because they're good. Submit to them because they're God's, because he has installed them. Think of the example of Jesus. Remember Jesus as he's being questioned by Pontius Pilate, who was an evil, wicked, unjust authority. Jesus Christ, after being flogged, is appearing before Pilate, and Pilate says, "Don't you know the authority that I have?" What does Jesus say? You would have no authority over me unless it had been given to you from above. Jesus is willing to submit himself even to the unjust, wicked, cowardly authority of Pontius Pilate, because that authority came from God. So even when you disagree with authorities in your life, followers of Jesus, you must submit to them because God has ordained their authority. Let me ask you, Christians, are you submitting to the authorities in your life? To the government? It's easy if you like the government or what the government's doing. It's hard if you don't. What about your boss? Do you look at your boss and think God is the one that established this authority? Or do you think, what a moron? What do you think when you go to work and your boss tells you to do something you don't like? Are you willing to believe and act as if God is the one that has put them in authority over you? What about spiritual authorities in the church, your pastors, wives? Are you willing to submit, to arrange yourself underneath? That's what the word submit means. Arrange yourself underneath the authority of a husband. Children, to the kids in this room, are you submitting to mom and dad? Parents, are you expecting your children to submit to you? Teaching them and raising them in such a way that they understand the importance of authority? If we're going to live justly, live wisely, respond rightly to unjust authorities in an evil world, we need to begin by remembering that God is the one that has established those authorities. But also, you must remember to respect your authorities no matter what. Here the preacher takes it up a notch. It's one thing to obey an authority. It's another thing to respect them. Now, if you're parents, any parents in this room, you know there's a difference between obedience and respect, right? My kids can obey while slamming the doors and muttering under their breath. And they can do the thing that I ask them to do. But they have not respected the authority, right? There's a difference between doing the right thing that your authority tells you to do and respecting them in the process. Submission is, it's about your actions. Respect is about your attitudes, your heart, the words that you say about those in authority over you. The preacher says it's not enough merely to obey the king. You must behave in a way that shows him respect. Look at verses 3 and 4. Be not hasty to go from his presence. Do not take your stand in an evil cause, for he does whatever he pleases. For the word of the king is supreme, and who may say to him, what are you doing? These verses are highlighting the need to respect those in authority over us. He says, don't be quick to leave the king's presence. Winston Churchill said that whenever he visited the king, he would always walk backwards. He wouldn't leave the room, turn around and turn his back on the king, but he'd always slowly walk backwards away from the king until finally he was able to leave, given permission to leave. Don't be someone who gets an audience with the king, gets an audience before your authority, and then you disrespect them in the process. That's what he's saying. When he says, don't take a stand in an evil cause, I think he's admonishing us, don't rebel against the king. The king does whatever he pleases. It was certainly true in the ancient world, wasn't it? The kings could do whatever they want. You could not go up to a king and say, what are you doing? His word was supreme. The preacher says we should respect our authorities, even if we disagree with them. Now, how do we apply these verses in a constitutional republic like the United States of America? Here's a thought. As Americans, I believe that we should support and defend our First Amendment right to speak dishonorable words about our leaders. I'm going to say it again. We should support and defend as Americans our First Amendment right to speak dishonorable words about our leaders. And yet as Christians, we should never take advantage of that right. As an American, you should have First Amendment rights to be able to make fun of a president or a politician. But as a Christian, you have zero legroom to do that. Your responsibility, followers of Jesus, is to respect those in authority over you. Now, again, this is really, really easy if you actually respect the leadership of your leaders. It's really, really hard if you don't. It's interesting. Sometimes I'll hear Christians talk a lot about the need to respect their politicians, their leaders, when it happens to be the person they voted for. And then we suddenly forget that for 4 years when someone else is in office. That's not the way that Christians should behave. There is a place for civil discourse and disagreement. There is no place for dishonoring those that God has put in authority over us. When Nero was the emperor in Rome, the Apostle Peter wrote this: be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do evil and to praise those who do good. Honor everyone. Love the brotherhood. Fear God. Honor the emperor. If the Holy Spirit can tell first century Christians to honor Nero, what would he say to you in the way that you respond to the leaders that you disagree with, whomever they may be? What would he require of you, Christian? Are you respecting your authority? Do you speak to them and about them respectfully? Once again, kids in the room, how do you talk to mom and dad? Do you speak with respect? Do you grumble? When they ask you to do something that you don't want to do, do you complain? Give them a list of 39 reasons why something else would be better. Or do you respect them and the way you talk to them? Parents, by the way, you are doing your children no favors if you allow disrespect to fester in the home. Now, that doesn't mean that you can always control it, but you can control how you respond to it. We have to expect our children and train our children to respect their authority no matter what. Now, what about those occasions when your authority tells you to do something wrong? What do we do then? Do we still respect them? Consider with me a third principle from Ecclesiastes chapter 8. Resist your authorities with great care. With great care. I want to suggest to you that we should always honor our authority and usually obey our authority. Always honor, usually obey. It's okay to disobey an authority if and when that authority commands you to do something that would disobey your ultimate authority, which is your Creator. I think there's some principles here that the preacher is illustrating in verses 5-7. Whoever keeps a command will know no evil thing, and the wise heart will know the proper time and the just way. For there is a time and a way for everything, although a man's trouble lies heavy on him. For he does not know what is to be, for who can tell him how it will be? Those verses can be pretty confusing, just reading them on its face, but I think the preacher is trying to get something like this across. Usually, it's best to obey your authorities, and when you do, usually things go well. That's why he says in verse 5, those who keeps a command know no evil thing. You know, typically, you don't get a speeding ticket unless you're what? You're speeding. Now, every time I've gotten a speeding ticket, I wasn't actually speeding. But most of the time, you did something, right? If you are keeping the law, if you're honoring the king, if you're doing what you're supposed to do, most of the time, you don't deal with the wrath of the king. It's the way the world typically works. And yet, a wise person knows there are times when a ruler might command you to do something that's wrong. Think of the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Remember in the book of Daniel, King Nebuchadnezzar decides to build a big golden statue. He builds this big golden statue, and he says, I've got a new law. We're going to make Babylon great again. He didn't really say that, but let's just say he did. Here's the new law. Everybody, here's what we're going to do. Come to my big golden image and bow down. I've got a band here. They're going to play. Maybe have a smoke machine. Lights are down. And then we all bow down before the golden image. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were followers of the true God. And they noticed that what Nebuchadnezzar was requiring was something that contradicted what he had already told them in his word. And so Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were troubled by this command. You see verse 6, it says, a man's trouble lies heavy on them. They were troubled by this command of the king. And they didn't know the future. They knew what he promised, if you disobey me, if you will not bow, you're going to get thrown into this fiery furnace. They knew that God could deliver, but they didn't know for sure. And so they knew that by disobeying the king, they were taking their own lives at risk. And yet they resisted anyways. But they did it carefully. Like verse 5 says, they did it at the proper time in a just way. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, this wasn't their first brush up with King Nebuchadnezzar. If you read Daniel chapter 1, there was another instance where the king was requiring a certain diet. And when that happened, they didn't say, "We refuse to eat the king's meat." They made an appeal. They asked a question. Could we do this instead of that? But here is not the time for appeal. When the king says, "Bow down and worship a golden image," the only right response in that moment is no. They did it respectfully. They honored the king in the way that they spoke to him, but they did not submit. They resisted him with great care. And even when they spoke to the king, they honored him as they resisted. So, brothers and sisters, if you're a follower of Jesus, there might be times when you and I too have to resist our authorities. I would suggest that like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, we should pick our battles. We should do it in the proper time. We should do it in a just way. We should, when we're able, we should operate within the confines and the constraints of the law as we resist. And yet there might be a time for some of us when the only right answer is no. I can't do that. I can't submit to that. We need great wisdom to navigate those situations. It will be better for you if and when the time ever comes for you to resist an authority, if you also, number four, recognize the limits of human power. Recognize the limits of human power. What can an authority do to you if you resist them? The answer is they can probably do more than you'd like, but less than you think. Look at verses 8 and 9. "No man has power to retain the spirit or power over the day of death. There is no discharge from war, nor will wickedness deliver those who are given to it. All this I observed while applying my heart to all that is done under the sun when man had power over man to his hurt." Evil authority can do a lot of damage. If you resist an evil authority, they could send you off to war. Think about the story of Uriah the Hittite. You remember? David impregnated his wife. David tried to get Uriah drunk. He couldn't. And so he sent him to the front lines, off to war. There's no discharge from war in the hands of an evil and unjust king. And so, nothing he could do. Sometimes an evil king can deliver you over to wickedness, like Joseph being thrown into slavery or thrown into prison, like the people of Israel being enslaved, or like Daniel being thrown in the lion's den, or Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego being thrown in the fiery furnace. Evil authority can do great damage. If you're going to resist your authority, you need to count the cost before you do so. There might be penalties or fines or expulsion or imprisonment. Like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you should trust God to deliver you through the fire, even if he doesn't deliver you from it. Evil authority can do a lot of damage, but there's a lot that they can't do. Look at verse 8 again. He says, "No man has power to retain the spirit." A king, even a king like Nebuchadnezzar or Pharaoh, can reach a lot of things, but he cannot reach the human heart. He cannot retain your spirit. He cannot grab you on the inside. Reminds me of those great words from Braveheart where he says, "They may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom." You can kill me, but there's things in me you can't take. You can't touch. The king can do a lot, but he cannot touch your soul. That is good news if your soul is secure in King Jesus. Surprisingly also in verse 8, the preacher tells us that the king doesn't have authority over the day of death. You see that? no man has power over the day of death. Isn't that interesting? Because haven't there been many kings who have killed many people? How can the preacher say the king has no authority, no power over the day of death? The king could kill you, couldn't he? Well, King Nebuchadnezzar tried to kill Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And how did it work out for him? No one can kill you, Christian, unless your heavenly Father permits it. The king, as powerful as he is, political rulers, as powerful as they are, they may be able to sentence you to death, but they cannot even carry out their own sentences unless God ordains it to be so. Consider the example of a missionary named John Patton. Patton was called by God to bring the gospel to the cannibals in the South Pacific island now known as Vanuatu. And after enduring multiple attempts on his life, listen to what he said. I realized that I was immortal till my master's work with me was done. The assurance came to me as if a voice out of heaven had spoken that not a musket would be fired to wound us, not a club prevail to strike us, not a spear leave the hand in which it was held vibrating to be thrown, not an arrow leave the bow or a killing stone the fingers without the permission of Jesus Christ, whose is all power in heaven and on earth. Do you believe that, Christian? Do you believe that the enemy cannot touch you apart from the will of God? How much of our anxieties could be lightened if we could just believe that we are invincible until the Father deems it not be so? This doesn't mean that we don't take precautions. It doesn't mean we don't care about safety and all of those things. But it does mean we can have a holy boldness and confidence that our God is king and none can stay his hand. None. You respond wisely to unjust authority when you recognize the limits of human power. But also you must, number five, realize the shortcomings of earthly justice. Look at verse 10. Then I saw the wicked buried. He goes to a funeral. And at this funeral, he sees this person. They used to go in and out of the holy place and were praised in the city where they had done such things. This also is vanity. This is a theme we've seen multiple times already in Ecclesiastes. One way of wording it is, why do bad things happen to good people? That's certainly a real question. We've already tackled it some, and we'll tackle it again as we continue to work through this book. The reverse question is also worth asking. Why do good things happen to bad people? Why do good things happen to bad people? Why does Elon Musk have $500 billion? I mean, couldn't I just get a little bit of that? The reason why the preacher gives us why good things often happen to bad people is because earthly justice is often very broken and flawed. Look at verse 11. Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed speedily, the heart of the children of man is fully set to do evil. What's he saying? That when justice is slowed, evil is encouraged. Parents, you can think about this in your own home. If your kids disobey you, and you say, your response is, one, two, three, four, don't let me get to 10, five, six, seven, eight. What are you teaching your kids? Just wait until she's about halfway through nine, and then I obey. Right? If you delay in bringing justice, evil is encouraged. We want a world, a just world, where a person takes another human's life and they're quickly brought to justice. That discourages evil. But when justice is delayed, when justice is slow, evil is encouraged. Even though earthly justice has its shortcomings, we should not and must not throw our hands up in the air and stop trying. I want to talk to you for a few moments. I'm going to just break away from Ecclesiastes and apply this for a minute to a situation that's happening in our own state, the Commonwealth of Virginia. This is something I don't typically do, but given the severity of what we're facing in our state, I want to talk to you about a political reality that's happening here. The Virginia House of Delegates has begun the process to amend the Virginia Constitution, amend the Virginia Constitution in such a way that this amendment would enshrine what's called reproductive freedom, not defined in the amendment, but would enshrine reproductive freedom as a fundamental right for all Virginians. There are no explanations for what reproductive freedom means, so it could allow abortions for the entire 9 months of pregnancy. Could allow abortions regardless of the age of the woman or girl carrying the baby, without regard to what mother or father might want. It could allow the mutilation of young boys and girls and their bodies in the name of gender ideology, because there are no boundaries to what this terminology actually means. And this amendment, if it were to pass, it would make those who speak and work against reproductive freedom to be guilty of violating the constitutional rights in our state, which could potentially make ministries like CareNet, a ministry that we support gladly and have for years as a church, illegal. It can make the sermons that you've heard me preach every year I've been your pastor against the evils of abortion considered unconstitutional language. This amendment has already passed once through the General Assembly and will be voted on a second time in January 2026. Right now, the Virginia House of Delegates is 51-49 pro-abortion. There is an election coming up in November, and it's the type of election that most Americans tend to sit out. It's not a presidential election. It's not a midterm election. No need to go to the polls. Not important. I've got other stuff to do. But let me say this, brothers and sisters, if you're a follower of Jesus and you care about the sanctity of unborn life, I would plead with you to know where your candidates stand on this issue and vote in a way that would prioritize life so that this amendment can be defeated. I know this might sound incredibly political. It's not my goal to be up here talking every Sunday about this or that issue in politics, but if you've been at PBC for more than a few years, you have heard me say repeatedly that abortion is the greatest injustice in our world today. I stand by that. I believe that wholeheartedly. And if there is a hurricane coming in our state that would drastically expand the powers of evil in our culture, and we don't speak against it, then I can't have a clean conscience before God and before you. I say these things not because I want this to be the thing we're always talking about every Sunday, but because it's something that's worth talking about today. Something worth pleading for you to think through today. We want a world where what is just and right is what's done, especially with the most vulnerable among us. As important as issues like this are, we cannot allow ourselves to think that justice is limited to what we can do under the sun. As we've already said in our big idea, wisdom can't fix everything. We have to look beyond the sun. Look at verses 12 to 14. Though a sinner does evil 100 times and prolongs his life, yet I know that it will be well with those who fear God because they fear before him. But it will not be well with the wicked, neither will he prolong his days like a shadow because he does not fear before God. There is a vanity that takes place on earth. Notice he says it's on earth, that there are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked. And there are wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. On earth, the righteous get what the wicked deserve. On earth, the wicked get what the righteous deserve. But there is coming a day when real justice will be done. The preacher says, those who fear God, it will be well with them in the end. There is coming a day when King Jesus, the just and righteous King, will return and make everything sad untrue. He will do what is right. And if you're in this room today and you are suffering injustice, Jesus sees you and he's coming and he's going to make it right. If you're in this room and you're a perpetrator of injustice, Jesus sees you, he's coming soon and he's going to make it right. What's your responsibility, friend? To fear God. To believe that you are a sinner deserving the holy, righteous, white, hot wrath of God. And Daphne read as we began our service this morning about the wrath of God poured out on Pharaoh and his riders as they tried to cross the Red Sea. The wrath of God will come upon you like a flood, friend, unless you have put your faith in King Jesus, the only one who can rescue you from this is to admit your sin and trust in the finished work of Jesus. Jesus put it this way in Luke chapter 12. I tell you, my friends, do not fear those who kill the body and after that have nothing more that they can do. But I will warn you whom to fear. Fear him who after he has killed has authority to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. Do you fear God, friend? If you put your faith in his son, Jesus Christ, that's the only way you'll be rescued from the wrath to come. I know all this is heavy. Some of this is really hard to hear, and it's difficult, and it'd be really tempting to kind of end the sermon on a really somber note, but the preacher won't let us do that. This is, even if it seems depressing, this is a book about joy. So consider with me number 6, 6th principle for living wisely under unjust authority, evil authority. Rejoice while you toil under the sun. What's there to rejoice about? There are evil rulers. There's people taking the life of unborn people. There's people that are not prepared for the judgment. What is there to rejoice about? Look at verse 15. And I commend joy. For man has nothing better under the sun but to eat and drink and be joyful, for this will go with him in his toil through the days of his life that God has given him under the sun. How can you rejoice while you're living under an unjust king who does whatever he pleases because his word is supreme? How can you rejoice when you're constantly under threat of someone who has power to hurt you if he wants? How can you rejoice when the wicked are praised while the righteous suffer? How can you rejoice when the wicked live long and the good die young? You have to look beyond the injustices of your circumstances to God's ability to turn them into good. Remember the story of Joseph? After all that injustice and all of that evil and all of that suffering, God used it to bring Joseph to the second highest place of authority in all of Egypt. And when he met his brothers and rescued his brothers, he said this in Genesis 50, verse 20. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. Perhaps Solomon is looking back to that story and encouraging his readers to rejoice because God can turn evil into good. If you're a follower of Jesus, you can look back to another story, an even better story. Like Joseph, Jesus was lied about and sold his enemies for a few pieces of silver, sold to his enemies for a few pieces of silver. Like Joseph, Jesus was falsely accused and arrested and mistreated. Like Joseph, Jesus suffered immensely. And like Joseph, Jesus' suffering was used by God to rescue his people. So cheer up, Christians. No matter what injustices you're facing, no matter what evil you're enduring, no matter how difficult your authorities, no matter what evil is celebrated in the culture, no matter what happens on election day, you are always doing better than you deserve. The preacher says, eat and drink, enjoy a good meal, eat a donut, drink whole milk, rejoice. Because when you celebrate, listen, when the Christian can celebrate amidst the ashes and the rubble around us, when we can rejoice when life hurts, we're practicing for eternity. It's significant that the symbol that Jesus gave his people to celebrate and remember his death in our place requires eating and drinking with joy. Hear these words. And then we'll pray before we take the Lord's Supper together. Joyfully, we join you at your table, pleading not our righteousness. By your wealth of mercy, we are able now to feast in confidence. Take this bread and eat. Take this cup and drink. Remember how he loves us. Rejoice and keep the feast. Would you pray with me?